What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. As shared in part one of her story, Kim is a mother and nurse from Indiana. She reached out to the Broken Cycle Media team in hopes of sharing her story for the first time, to bring awareness to a trajectory she never thought she would have had to traverse. Nearly a decade into her marriage, her whole life changed with a home raid by the FBI and several other criminal justice forces. The organizations would consequently find a large catalog of child sexual abuse material in her then-husband's possession. However, at the start, Kim wasn't aware of all the facets of his crime, and it would take her years to learn everything, as well as to receive what closure the legal system offered. We are so grateful that Kim was willing to highlight all that continues to come next for her and her children, and that she's sharing her immense fortitude and strength with our audience today.
I did file for divorce. I was surprised to find that I was told his right to parent was kind of largely not going to be affected by his convictions and his crimes and behavior. It wasn't going to really affect his parenting time until such time that we could prove in court that he had directly physically harmed my children. So they were going to protect essentially every other minor in at least the nation except my two from this man because they were biologically related. According to his plea agreement, he was sentenced to 7 years in prison. Those years were surprisingly more difficult than I expected. I don't know what you can expect, but his parents were fairly wealthy, certainly far more wealthy than I am or than my family is. They had the means to really push some things in regards to family court. We did do mediation. That was an interesting experience because he could not be there. Obviously, he was in prison in Texas. So I essentially divorced my mother-in-law. That was just so weird. Not something I expected. We ended up with the initial divorce decree that outlined things. So in regards to the children specifically, they were to have two phone calls a week with him. It's my job to facilitate that they participate in those calls. When he called to talk to the kids, I would be in the background so that I could supervise, quote unquote, the conversation and make sure that there wasn't anything that might be unhealthy or inappropriate occurring, but I didn't speak or make noise during those calls. They had to visit him in prison in Texas or wherever else he's placed if he's transferred at least once a year. Him or his family are to fund the travel costs. I can't remember if it was once a year or twice a year, but I had to send an update for each child, like what kind of activities are they into? What are they up to? How are they doing generally? I had to include their grades. I had to include a piece of artwork and a piece of schoolwork. I also had to send their school pictures annually or twice a year if I ordered them twice a year. I told them I could send it to someone else in the extended family. Whatever they choose to do with it, I can't quite control. I myself could not directly do that because of specifically his crimes. I felt that was really unsafe. And then on their end, his mother had to send statements for each of the children's college accounts, which he was able to retain. But since he's in prison, he cannot manage them. So he would be the owner and she as the POA would send those statements. This was a strange piece to me because although I wasn't entirely surprised about their relationship with money, it became far more glaringly clear the role that money and wealth plays in their family. And to be fair, they did put in the majority of the money that was put into the accounts. But once you give that gift, in my mind, those accounts belonged to each of the children. It was our job as adults to manage them until the children were old enough to be able to manage it on their own. But I never saw it as my money or his money, or certainly not his parents' money. That really struck me. That was hard for me to wrap my head around. I wasn't getting any support whatsoever, not even a penny. They pulled the "he has no income" card. I think there were some things he certainly could have cashed in or withdrawn from to help make sure his kids had clothing on their backs and food on the table. The kids would get lots of letters from him, paintings, drawings, all kinds of things throughout the entire 6 years. I think we still have every one of them. I learned to keep everything, file everything as best I could for our own protection with letters and the calls. He stayed very connected in that way. That didn't let up over time. Our focus was letting the kids dictate to an extent what they were wanting or needing. For example, with phone calls, if he would call, there were times where my son would really want to talk to him. And then there were other times he was very adamant, like, no, I'm not in the mood right now. Maybe he's playing and he doesn't want to stop doing that. He's needing that distraction from the grief. The phone calls didn't take into any consideration what they were doing. So that was hard to manage. And same with the visits. While I did want the kids to be able to visit or see him, as much as I didn't like going, I felt like for their health and grief, as they sought to just kind of reconcile what had happened and how things had changed and what their relationship with him was or would be like, that they were able to have a visit when they really needed, within reason. Of course, it was in another state, so that made it a little tricky. But I did not want them to be forced, because a prison visit is stressful for me as an adult, so I cannot imagine as a child having to go through that whole process of being patted down. You have to wear specific things. There's a lot of waiting. There are a lot of rules. And just the sensory aspect, seeing those big metal doors and bars loudly opening and clanking shut, seeing your parent be in a prison uniform or having to walk behind this side of the line, it's tough. And so to ask that of them, if they aren't in a place at that moment, I was afraid that they were going to be forced because of how things had unfolded with the divorce itself. Everything was getting more contentious. There were times where they were filing all kinds of complaints here and there and everywhere. I got a letter out of nowhere saying, you aren't doing this, you aren't doing that. We're going to try and bring you back into court or get you on contempt of court. It was his mom, typically, because she was his POA and she seemed to be the person that would mainly put things into action Now, I don't know if it was directly at his behest from behind bars that became a big focus. So I'm sure that was not only a distraction, but it also was a way to really vilify me. Then he wasn't the villain. He became the victim in their eyes. I did begin to wonder what narrative he was sharing with his family. And maybe even if he was driving that wedge between us even further, again, so that we didn't talk, we became more separate, me and his family. It became pretty clear that he would go to great lengths and did with me to try to explain things away or to garner sympathy or make himself the victim. It was just getting tougher, those relationships all around. So my fear was losing control to advocate for my children. I put a lot of effort into trying to never speak ill of their biological father in front of them, to them, or where they could overhear. I may have felt that way, but I didn't feel it was for them to hear, especially at that young age. In trying to shield them from all these things, it just got really difficult to navigate it all. And then meanwhile, also trying to juggle in the background, do I have enough money to keep the lights on this month? What are the kids needing? What was going on with my children, maybe medically? I didn't have the money for a lawyer, so I tried to just not say anything, to try and only have communication that was absolutely necessary. It certainly felt like his priority and his parents' priority became very self-focused, whether it was intentional or not. Our divorce was finalized January of 2015. At that point, the plan was getting through the incarceration. Things became very rough with him, the relationship with his family and me, and then trying to keep the kids shielded from these things that were divorce-related issues. The 85% of a sentence is what I believe has to be served in federal court, but there wasn't an option to get out earlier than his 85%. There was kind of a projected release date. So the earliest he could be released was on the BOP prison inmate locator website. So we had an idea of that date. Just prior to the release, these twice a week, it kind of turned into once a week phone calls. Mostly it was my son that was talking. My daughter really, really refused to participate. Not too long before his release date, he began to get more aggressive in arguing for reunification therapy. He would say things like, "I'm not going anywhere. You better just get along with me because I'm going to be involved with the kids. I'm going to be having parenting time with them." He had written a few letters prior to his release talking about for the kids. "Oh, I can't wait to talk to you for longer than 15 minutes was the time limit while he was incarcerated. And talking about things that they were going to go do, or that at some point they would go travel and go on all these adventures, saying that he was going to live at Lake Geneva, and then saying he was coming to Indianapolis, which is where the court said he was supposed to report back to. That was a really tough spot for me as a parent, because even though I didn't want this man involved with my children, I knew also that it broke, especially my son's heart, hearing all of these promises that he was being given. He went to bed every night for 6.5 years on the promise that his dad was going to come back someday and be this fantastic dad that vacationed with him and took him on adventures. But I knew that that wasn't the reality. And we're working in the system with reunification, the supervised release, and with the registry. I wanted, obviously, the kids to be safe. And so this was going to be tough. The tone had shifted in his demands in regards to the kids before he even got out. So their therapist did agree, given what he was saying, that we did need to start digging into preparing the kids. At that time, my daughter was only 11, maybe. She didn't know the details of his crimes. She didn't want to know. She made that very clear. There was a lot of emotional work and therapy the kids were going through. That was hard for me, again, because it wasn't when they were ready for it. And I felt like that was something I couldn't really protect them from. He ultimately was released on December 31st, 2018. In essence, 2019 was the beginning of him on the other side of this fence. I was very anxious leading up to it. He was to report to a halfway house, the same place where he had spent time during pretrial. And the purpose of that place on the back end of a sentence is to kind of help you get settled somewhere, help you reintegrate into society, get you set up with your supervised release and the registry and all the things, because he had been incarcerated for a significant enough period of time. Well, I got a phone call from the FBI, I want to say maybe 3 days after he had been released, and they asked if I knew his location. And I'm thinking, you should be the ones keeping tabs on him. They said they did not know where he was, that he had just failed to show up, that he did not call. I felt I was back in that quicksand cloudiness. I was back in crisis mode. I wondered if he was hurt in some way and he can't get there. You just got out. You're going to go right back in. That began a few days of being terrified, especially for my children. The marshals showed up next. I was getting my son ready for school. And all of a sudden, we heard knocking at the front door and also knocking at the back doors all at the same time. There's that moment of what's going on. We had also been a little wary of answering doors, not knowing the exact location of his dad at this point. We kind of held each other for a minute, a little scared. And then I went and I answered the door. It was the United States Marshals. It did feel like being thrown right back into that initial raid. Here is law enforcement again on every side of my house, questioning whether or not I'm hiding him or giving him a place to stay and not telling them. This time, I invited them in. I invited my son to go ahead and join us in talking. My son was now in high school. I think that helped for him a lot. This was, again, happening to him. Here he had just been told by his dad days ago, and in all these recent phone calls, he was waiting for this exciting life that would be on the other end of the incarceration. Having him just go dark and disappear, it was like another abandonment. So I think my son being able to participate in this conversation helped him feel like he was a part of it and it wasn't all just being done to him, and then him being told about it after the fact. The U.S. Marshals, they had involved Interpol. They were looking into whether or not he had tried to go to Germany, since that is where his parents were from originally, and they had dual citizenship. He also had dual citizenship, technically. They said they did not see a flight that he was on or anything that looked like his alias or his picture on an ID. So the search continues, but at least I was connected up with them. I really feared that he knows he's gone rogue. What does he have to lose at this point? Because he's going back to prison, was my thought. So I felt like that put him in a position to do things that may be far more reckless, possibly violent. Right after that conversation, at the direction of the U.S. Marshals, I got in touch with the security teams at each of my children's schools to make sure they knew, please do not release either of these children to this man or anyone in his family. At my son's school, they were wonderful in regards to getting a picture of him. They were agreeable to not sharing information and not releasing him to his biological father or his biological father's family. My daughter's school, when I reached out to them, they said, well, is he on the birth certificate as her father? And I said, yes. And they said, well, then we will release her unless I could produce a family court document that explained he could not have custody. So even though I said, look, the United States Marshals are looking for him, there's an active warrant for his arrest. This was related to crimes against children. So my daughter's school wanted a document. I couldn't get in a timely manner. By the grace of God, I reached back out to the marshal that was lead on this case, and he was amazing. They really were pretty incredible at helping me protect my children. He immediately got in his black SUV and went to the school, spoke to the security director, showed them the warrant, and explained the situation and ensured that they would not release her to him or to anyone else that we don't know, nor would they give out information on her location. It was huge. I almost get tearful thinking about it. Looking back, I am so, so grateful for everyone that worked on this, for everyone on those teams, for the FBI, for the marshals, because had they not intervened when they did, I can't even imagine the danger or the harm that could have and probably would have come to us had we just continued to live under the same roof with this man having no idea what he was capable of and what he was doing. He had very early on, after leaving the prison, instead of coming directly to Southern District of Indiana to report, had gone straight from there to Chicago. I later was told by a family member that they had a big celebration and family dinner. Then the next morning, he was flown to Poland and then to Germany. He certainly had had assistance because he did not come out of prison with any finances. His driver's license would have expired. He wouldn't have had a passport, wouldn't have had a car. He wouldn't have had any of the means to carry any of this out. It was very clear he had violated not only the parts of his sentence to report for supervised release, to register as a sex offender in the state he returned to do the sex offender treatment program. There were all of these stipulations. He had violated the one that would hold the greatest punishment or sentence was a violation of, I believe, the International Megan's Law that stated anytime a sex offender flies from one country to the other, that those countries would give the other prior notification. So he was supposed to notify things on our end so that our government can notify Germany in advance of his travel. And that did not occur. There were a slew of other smaller things that they technically could seek convictions on if they wanted. But so they seemed to be really going after this. That was where we were at when the district attorney or the prosecutor for the case said, we're going to have to dial things back at the moment because he has that citizenship. That's going to make it a little more difficult to extradite him, although not impossible. Whereas Germany is viewing us as the foreign country and them as his home country. It just raises the standard of how serious that crime, that each charge needs to be to make it simpler, but certainly makes it all a little more complicated with his dual citizenship. It paused things for a bit. It felt a little bit deflated or set back after that. They have continued to stay in touch with me as issues have arose over these last few years since he has been out. It's kind of a sit and wait game. not too long ago. He had received multiple bank account verifications. It says, you've asked for all of your statements to come electronically, but we send this initial one just to verify that you receive it at the address that you put in and that all of the contact information you provided is correct. I don't think they banked on that when they opened the accounts because they used my address. That was not an error. It was brand new accounts that were being opened. And at that point, years after he had been out living in Germany and having a German address or addresses. So he has been in Germany essentially since his release. What's so terrifying is that he masked those things so well. That connection that we all really thought we saw in the beginning, in those early years, where he was so involved and hands-on and seemingly appeared to be a great parent. He now is essentially saying, I didn't want to have to go through being on the registry or that being public. I'm going to go make my life easier in Germany, but it is at the expense of a lot of things for the kids. Again, it's hard for me because this is not a man that I want here with my kids. But to just ignore that any of this has happened, that none of these crimes occurred, from my perspective, is the most dangerous decision that we could make, not just for everyone else around him, but for him. Because I would wager everything I have, which isn't a lot, but it's everything I have, on the fact that he is still offending. I truly think all of that has emboldened him further. I think if his family loved him and cared about him and his long-term outcome, they would be supporting him in getting help. I think in my experiences with him and what I've learned, he needs those external parameters there. He doesn't display that he has the self-control to manage his own impulses in this situation. They have set up this perfect situation for him to reoffend again because he has this blank slate where now everything here is sealed. That means certainly in Germany, no one can see this has been an issue, so much so that he has already been convicted, has served a sentence, was incarcerated for over 6 years. He has not stepped up to any of his responsibilities. So all of these things have set him up to be in an even better position now to prey on children and other young women. That's been really hard for me to sit with. There are a few hopes or reasons why I'm sharing now. I felt like I was silent for so long. I mean, I put energy into being silent for so many years, primarily for my children. It was best for them if they were as shielded as possible, especially as the digital world and the internet and social media has all boomed. They didn't need the whole world coming at them about the situation in their life. So trying to shield them from that public eye, I worked really hard to just share with family, close friends, those people that were in our supportive circle. I also have felt like since he absconded to Germany, especially, and as time has gone on, my staying silent was almost kind of enabling, in a way, him to be able to continue preying on children and young women.
As the Office of Sex Offender Sentencing, Monitoring, Apprehending, Registering, and Tracking Case Law website explains, federal law makes it a crime for sex offenders to fail to register or update their registration as required by SORNA. But offenders that are released from the Federal Bureau of Prisons are not registered by the Bureau. Each federal inmate must take the steps to register themselves in the state-level public sex offender registries, which each state is required to maintain. According to a communications liaison for the Indiana Sex Offender Registry, if a person does not register, the county can choose to mark them as failure to register and include the address information that was included in their arrest record and/or reported at the time of their release in their registry. Also, in the event that offenders don't register, the U.S. Marshals Service is responsible for assisting jurisdictions in locating and apprehending sex offenders who violate their sex offender registration requirements. Even though Kim's ex-husband was required by law to register in his home state's sex offender registry within the first few days of his release, he never returned to Indiana and did not register. In this event, the case is handed over to the marshals, as SORNA describes is typical policy. However, because Wyatt fled the country, the marshals allegedly didn't possess properly updated information for his location, and thus did not publish anything to the registry. To Kim, this clearly highlights a potential loophole for offenders to remain off the registry, especially in the event that the offender first served a federal sentence, then was required to register at state level.
I was shocked to find out that if someone runs prior to that initial registering for the sex offender registry, their name never shows up anywhere on the registry. They just aren't in it. So even if they've been convicted, they've been sentenced to register, if they don't show up for that very first appointment, their name is nowhere near the registry. And I think those especially are the people that we should be extremely concerned about potentially being dangerous or potentially continuing their criminal behaviors. So that shocked me. That makes me worried for current or future victims.
Having navigated everything that you've navigated, are there any other changes you'd make to the criminal justice system or the legal system to help better support victims?
There certainly are a lot of things that we could change. One is certainly this loophole in the registry that needs to be looked at. It's really hard as a family or as family members going through this system. Ultimately, I was victimized, but because they didn't charge him for that crime, I'm not listed anywhere or treated by the justice system in any way like a victim. And I don't mean to take away at all from the children or other young women that he victimized with these images and sharing images. They absolutely were victims. It ripples out victims that it affects. And I feel like we don't look at that bigger effect sometimes. And so those people get a little lost in the bigger system. For example, trying to find help for my two kiddos when they were very little, they had experienced essentially a loss of a parent. Now, that parent didn't die, but that parent was yanked out of their life very abruptly and in a traumatic way. But we don't have a lot of support for victims, but especially those victims with children who have an incarcerated parent. They might do okay at a grief support group for loss of parents, but they're ostracized from that because their parents are still alive technically. So they don't fit into any one space. And we just really don't have many, if any, support groups. These children are completely innocent. They didn't commit a crime, but they are absolutely serving a sentence for a crime they didn't commit. The play therapist was godsend. It actually was through that therapist that we then became connected with one other therapist whom we all still see. So he's walked through really the largest part of this whole journey with all of us and even our extended family. And then the support system I had in place and didn't even realize I had was phenomenal. I've never really been a great receiver. I need to be better at it. And I found that right when I was in the thick of it, when he was first arrested, if someone asked me, how can I help? I honestly didn't know how to take all these people that were graciously offering to help and kind of organize who should do what, when, and how. I just wasn't able to mentally coordinate all that at that time. There were a couple friends, one who they came and mowed my lawn and left some chocolate chip cookies they'd made. They didn't even ask. She just knew the lawn needed to be mowed, and it did. It was like you just came home one day and the grass was mowed. I know it's a hard balance. You don't want to overstep at all when someone's going through a tough time like that, certainly. But as much as you feel comfortable, if your relationship is close enough that you feel comfortable, just go ahead and take something off their plate. Go ahead and buy the paper towels they need or the tissues they need, even if it's something really small. I didn't even know how to say thank you. That was huge. And I think taking care of myself was something that I did recognize that I should probably be doing. I don't think that I did it well, or that I recognized when I needed to stop and take care of myself early enough. I think I ended up paying some prices for that. In hindsight, I maybe would have done it differently. Don't be afraid to do what you need to do to ask for help for you. If you are caring for others in whatever trauma or crisis you're going through, you need to take care of you for them. We were very much associated with this very taboo subject of child sexual abuse. We know that it happens, unfortunately. I think it happens far more than we would like to think, because they are so taboo and no one in society wants to talk about them, which is understandable. But I think that results then in victims, family members, all of these people, that it ripples out and affects. I think it helps send a signal to them to be quiet. It felt like we were the only ones that this had happened to. And so I think in turn, people end up shying away from anyone that's even remotely related to it. Like they could catch it like a cold. But then that ends up really isolating the people that are being affected by it. And again, sends to them the message that you shouldn't say anything. It increases the shame that they are already feeling. I think the more that we are willing and able to talk about it in a healthy way, only good things are going to come from that. We need to talk about the things that need to change within the system. And we need to be willing to talk about just the topic itself. So when this occurs, it does just ripple out awareness about it. It's a good thing. Before this, I'd spent a little bit of time in prayer, like just help me find the words that I'm supposed to have, or those words that are maybe meant for someone else. I just hope that what I did share speaks to at least one other person.
You are an absolute gift to the world. Especially a gift to the world today, because it's your birthday.
This opportunity means a tremendous deal. Thank you, Amy. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
As a founder, I had an idea. I didn't know if it was going to work. I just knew I wanted to do something, and I wanted to help people. And to have an institution like the University of Kentucky College of Social Work say, yes, this needs to be done. Man, I felt 10 feet tall. That's the only way to say it. This is the best thing I've ever done in my life. And to have people buy into it, it's pretty special.
Whether you're a coach, you're a parent, or you're a player, if you're an administrator, director, or board member, maybe your program doesn't have a rules and ethics committee. Maybe you don't have a standardized safe sport reporting process. There's various needs that these organizations have, and we can help support you with those materials and help you with your planning of it. If you're a community member on any level in the youth sporting ecosystem and you have questions, there's a good chance that we got an answer for them. And if we don't, we're going to find one.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production, co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.